Welcome back to the program. For the past 9 years, my guest, Ken Gormley, a professor at Duquesne University, has worked on what he calls the definitive neutral history about President Clinton's impeachment. His new 800-page book, The Death of American Virtue, Clinton vs. Starr, analyzes the events surrounding Clinton's impeachment while offering some new revelations about many of the key players. It is my pleasure to welcome Ken Gormley here this morning to talk about the death of American virtue. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Jeff.
It's great to have you here. Many years ago when former Chinese Premier Chou Enlai was asked about the French Revolution in 1789, his answer was, it's too soon to know. Is it too soon to really comprehend and understand the totality of what this country went through with respect to the Clinton impeachment?
Well, yes and no. Certainly when we were in the midst of it, it was too close in time to really have any perspective on it. One of the reasons I set out to write this book, actually, Jeff, is I had written the biography of Archibald Cox, the great Watergate special prosecutor who stood up to President Nixon. I learned in writing that book, because a chapter dealt with the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, actually in 1868, some of the best accounts written of the Johnson impeachment trial were written by people who lived through it, who were alive at the time, and who talked to some of the people. And that's what I set out to do. So I did get access to, spoke to President Clinton three times, twice at his home in Chappaqua, interviewed Ken Starr for 50 hours or more, Monica Lewinsky, Paula Jones, Linda Tripp, Janet Reno, Henry Hyde. So it is still too soon to know all of the pieces, but these people were able to tell me things they could not talk about at the time, and I was also able to get documents that were not available at the time.
Is there a nexus in the public consciousness, not in fact, but in concept, between understanding what we went through with respect to Watergate and the Clinton impeachment?
Sure, I think so. There are a lot of ties, and certainly in my work, Washington is a very small town, and lots of the people who played roles in Watergate end up popping up in some fashion, especially lawyers in the Clinton scandals. But I do think there's been a sort of progression, and in some ways, some people would mark Watergate as the beginning of this kind of real split and an angry divide between Democrats and Republicans, and of course the Robert Bork hearings fostered that, and Iran-Contra. But in my mind, there's nothing like this episode in American history, where literally you had everyone in every grocery store in the United States talking about it, taking polar opposite views about whether Ken Starr or Bill Clinton was the good guy or bad guy, and literally dividing the country down the middle. And frankly, I believe this is the genesis of the divide we have today, that we describe as red states and blue states, and this kind of angry division that still exists within the country.
You talk about that, and your view that this is somehow the, if not the birth of that, something that certainly gave it an awful lot of trajectory. To what extent are the cultural issues inherent in this? Put politics slightly aside for the moment, mm-hmm. but the cultural issues that surround this and what it was about, to what extent were they central to this story?
Well, there's no question that that was a key piece of this. I mean, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton entered the White House at a time when there was a large group of people who already believed he was some sort of accidental president, that he did not belong in the White House. And it was based upon, you know, this notion he was a draft dodger, dope smoker, philanderer, and this seemed to just reinforce all of that as the Paula Jones scandal came to light, Monica Lewinsky. And layer on top of that, don't forget, Jeff, this is really the first time in our history where you had a president and a first lady who was equally significant in terms of the power structure. And that rankled a lot of people. So there were a lot of things going on here. And that cultural divide was very clear, I think. And what was so interesting to me is I spent a lot of time in Arkansas, where Bill Clinton grew up, and with friends of his dating back to his childhood. But I also spent time in Texas seeing people who had known Ken Starr since he was a boy. What was so interesting is these two men in many ways were very similar. They were born within a month of each other, within a couple hundred miles of each other, but they took a different path. So Ken Starr represented that, you know, conservative Christian mold in the United States, and Bill Clinton represented, you know, what some would consider the more liberal trajectory for both Southern men, both who became successful at very early ages. And so to see the collision of those forces is really fascinating.
And it was the collision of those forces, because if we look at it just from a political perspective, it's hard to label Bill Clinton as anything but a political centrist in the way his politics resulted in his governance. But it was really on these other issues that the divide was so great.
Yes, I think that there is a lot of truth to that, and I think that that's what drove the wedge so deeply between the public. And then also just this notion, I have to say that when you get right that bore down to the essence of it, the real division is whether this was about sex and someone's private life, or was it about lying under oath? I mean, that's how you can distill this down to its essence in terms of the conflicting views of it. And of course, it's about both, and it's about what, okay, when you find someone has lied about something that most people will lie about, that is having an extramarital affair, what is the punishment that fits that crime? And that's where the big gulf existed in terms of perceptions in this country.
It's also where the divide came down. I mean, when you get to that essence that you're talking about, it's where the divide came down in terms of what narrative the public was willing to believe. And clearly the narrative, to the extent that this was a story about sex, and the narrative the Clintons were able to put out, was the more compelling narrative at the end of the day.
Yes, and I would say that some of that was aided, ironically, by Ken Starr himself. One of the things I discovered in interviewing people close to President Clinton in the White House was that the moment that he was, the period of time when he was most at risk, most in jeopardy of literally losing the presidency, was after his grand jury testimony, where in August of 98, as you remember, he finally, after denying it and saying, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," admitted that he had had an affair. What they were concerned about then was that his own party, the Democrats in Congress, were going to force him to resign. And if you remember, that's what forced Richard Nixon out.
Right.
It was his own team. It was the Republicans. He was at the high point of jeopardy after that, when he flies off in the helicopter to Martha's Vineyard. And the irony of it is that it was the Starr Report, which was viewed as so over the top and so extreme, that galvanized and united the Democrats in Congress behind Bill Clinton again, and galvanized Hillary Clinton, the aggrieved wife, who said, "Wait a minute, this is my anger. It's not supposed to be a political weapon against my husband, Bill." And suddenly she was back leading the charge behind him. So ironically, it was the Starr Report itself that convinced a large number of people that this had gone too far.
In many ways, there is the perception in looking at this that Ken Starr was kind of doing what federal prosecutors do, which is to sort of push the charges as far as they could possibly go in the hopes that, you know, it will lead you to something else and that you can get an indictment on something perhaps lesser than what you went for. The problem is that in the court of public opinion, it didn't work.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because I guess a lot of people would disagree with that premise that that's what prosecutors are supposed to do, or at least people I've spoken to.
Federal prosecutors.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, Ken Starr I have great respect for. He's just a wonderful person, a luminary in the legal field. I have great, great respect for him. He'll be a fabulous president at Baylor University. He was not a prosecutor by training. He was a judge, as you know. He had been
right.
A federal appeals judge, solicitor general of the United States. I don't think Ken fully had an innate sense, and this isn't bad. I'm not a prosecutor either. But part of a true prosecutor is, when you're talking about the attorney general, the U.S. attorney, the person in charge, a big part of their job is actually to know how to restrain your own team, to keep your prosecutors in check so that they don't push that hard. And, you know, here he had a very aggressive stable of prosecutors, and that's what the people out in the trenches do that. They're banging against the cage and pushing and charging. But the person in charge ultimately has to restrain them. Ken was more of the approach that he would sit down, take the views of his team, and then make a reasoned decision. That didn't help here, because when they pushed hard to expand into the Monica Lewinsky case, that's where this went off the track. Ken allowed it to go off the track at that point, thinking that, you know, it was the wish of his team. And I think if he had that decision to do over again, he would have done it differently.
Somewhere in the perception of this, and when he started to go after Lewinsky, when he started to examine all of the women that Clinton may have been involved with in Arkansas, it seemed to go from a search for the truth, which is where it started with respect to Madison Guarantee, to get at the truth, and then it became to get at the Clintons. And there was definitely a point that tipped.
Yes, and I would identify that point in the winter of 1997. Ken Starr had announced he was going to Pepperdine, if you remember. He was clobbered over the head by both Democrats and Republicans, who said, "Wait a minute, why are you leaving now? You haven't finished." He beat a hasty retreat and stayed in the job. And it was shortly after that Bob Woodward actually first broke the news, and I interviewed Bob Woodward, that Ken Starr's investigators were interviewing women in Arkansas about past sexual relations with President Clinton. Now, Ken and his prosecutors told me they were just being diligent, turning over every rock to make sure there was no one there that they had forgotten to talk about having to do with the Whitewater investigation or whatever. But as Bob Woodward said, the atmosphere changed then. And then, of course, not long after that, we have Linda Tripp coming to the prosecutors with her infamous tapes, where she had tape-recorded Monica Lewinsky, turns those over. And when I interviewed Ken Starr's prosecutors, they freely admitted they believed so deeply that both President and Hillary Clinton were lying to them in the Whitewater matter that finally they were, as one person said it, ahead of the curve, and they couldn't resist going after this. That's a dangerous thing when a prosecutor wants to get ahead of the curve. That's not their job.
And there was a point that you talk about in mid-98 when they were about to, or thinking about, indicting Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yes. And, in fact, I obtained a copy of that draft indictment, which no one else has ever seen, including President or Mrs. Clinton. I found it in a place it shouldn't have been, and so I was able to read the whole thing. It was actually a draft indictment of Hillary Clinton and Webster Hubbell, yet again, for Whitewater-related charges. What was really interesting about it, Jeff, is the timing. That was in April of 1998. So this is in the thick of the Lewinsky investigation, where there's a standoff, where President Clinton is denying an affair. Monica Lewinsky is not yet cooperating. They haven't been able to sign her up for immunity, and so we're at a gridlock, and they're pushing in every direction. And one of the ways they're pushing is really considering indicting the First Lady. And Hickman Ewing Jr., who led that piece of the investigation in Arkansas, told me only half facetiously that he believed that Monica saved Hillary, in the sense that there was just so much potential evidence on the Monica Lewinsky charges. It was so clear-cut, they believed that President Clinton lied. They did not think it was going to be possible to convict Hillary Clinton. The case would get transferred to Washington. It would be a very sympathetic jury. And so they abandoned that and put all of their eggs in the basket of the Monica Lewinsky case.
And what were they going to indict her on?
Oh, it all related to charges of her work on Jim McDougal's savings and loan, fraudulent transactions. Very honestly, when you boil it down to its essence, a lot of it had to do with allegations that she lied in testifying about what she remembered about things. So, her involvement in these SNL deals was relatively minimal. In fact, the infamous billing records that surfaced in the White House that had been missing for a couple of years really confirmed that Hillary Clinton did only about 25 hours, I believe, on the main project, the Castle Grande project with Jim McDougal, that was the source of their concern. So it wasn't the underlying conduct as much as supposedly lying in recalling whether she had participated in these things, and also in lying and saying she didn't know how the billing records got there. So it was kind of these second-tier sorts of allegations.
To what extent was the death of Vince Foster a key moment in the story?
It was a key moment. And that's what was so fascinating about writing this book, Jeff, because there are books about Whitewater, there are books about Paula Jones, books about the impeachment or Monica, but no one to this point has been able to show how everything ties together and to talk to both sides, and that's what I set out to do. It was very clear in talking to some of the key Clinton people that the Vince Foster suicide, and it was a suicide, and I talked to his close friends, he was clearly depressed, he was just eaten alive by Washington. But the tragic irony of his death is it accomplished precisely the opposite of what he ever would have wanted, and that is the Whitewater investigation, which was dead as a doornail in Arkansas, it had pretty much just completely fizzled out, all of a sudden comes roaring back to life because people are seeing conspiracies under every rock. And then comes the American Spectator story right after Vince Foster's death about this woman named Paula going to the hotel room. And as someone said, people start connecting dots that don't connect. And all of a sudden, all of this stuff comes back to life that had pretty much been dead.
It's interesting because, as you say, it was difficult at the time, and even in some of the books that have been written since, to connect all those dots, to understand the totality of the story. And part of, I think, what helped the Clintons throughout this was this very fact of people connecting dots that weren't there, because they were so easy to deconstruct at the time.
Well, I guess so. Another way of saying that, if you were to ask President Clinton, which I did, there were never any dots to connect. I mean, his view was here, he and Hillary had lost money on this failed land deal. They themselves had been essentially defrauded by Jim McDougal, and this was turning into a scandal. They thought that they would just turn over the documents and that would be the end of it. Likewise with the Paula Jones matter. And I have to say that despite the fact that I believe 90% of what Paula Jones said in terms of her account, the 10% is the part I have a question with, and clearly, this is the part that has driven President Clinton crazy, I think, and that is we don't really know what Paula Jones's role in that was, in those events was, because when she came to that hotel room, whatever happened, a very much overlooked fact is she was engaged to be married at that time to one Stephen Jones, who, by all accounts of others, was a hot-headed fellow and detested Bill Clinton. So she certainly had a motive to shade the facts in terms of her own involvement, because if you remember, the trooper there said that she was not at all upset when she came out of the room and that she, in fact, handed over her phone number and wanted to be the governor's girlfriend. So, each of these pieces, in President Clinton's view, he was just being set up for political purposes at every stage, and I think that's why he became reckless at the end and was willing to not testify truthfully under oath. To him, this was all a political trap.
You talk about this film, The Clinton Chronicles, which Clinton's lawyer, Bob Bennett, was kind of anxious to show to a jury at some point if need be.
Well, it wasn't the film, The Clinton Chronicles, which, if you've ever seen it, is pretty extreme and alleges, that he was killing people and running drugs in Arkansas. It was the raw footage that was taken of Paula Jones, a little tiny segment of which appeared in that. And that raw footage, which I have seen from my own sources, is astounding in the sense, and this is what Bob Bennett was prepared to show to a jury. This was before Paula Jones became well known on the national scene, where she was literally lobbying to get her story out. She did not, this doesn't have anything to do with the truth of what she's saying or whatever. I'm talking about the perceptions of being this a grieved woman who had been, you know, just outraged by Governor Clinton's conduct. She seems irreverent. You know, she's blowing raspberries into the camera, laughing. Now, you know, I don't know the causes of all that. All I can tell you is that Bob Bennett planned on showing this to a jury, and I think it would have dramatically undermined any case. And incidentally, one of the most startling discoveries I made was a letter from Paula Jones's Virginia lawyers to her at the time she rejected a settlement. They thought they had the case settled with Clinton's lawyers, and Clinton agreed to it, to pay her the full amount, $700,000, she requested in her complaint. She turned that down, and they begged her to take it, and in this letter said that her case was worth at most $50,000 if she recovered anything because it was so weak. So her lawyers clearly knew that this was a weak case, and in any other scenario, if it wasn't the President of the United States, it would have been worth next to nothing.
Do the Clintons, Bill Clinton specifically, does he see in retrospect or believe that he played a key role in kind of amping up the situation in a way that kept driving Starr further and further?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's, you know, when you talk about being too close in time to history, I'm not sure what, I think President Clinton is still so very angry about this set of, this whole crazy scenario that you couldn't have made up in your wildest dreams, that it's hard to reflect calmly on that. I do think that, you know, there is no way this whole crazy story unfolds without President Clinton contributing to it in terms of his own reckless conduct. One simple example to show that is that at the time, the United States Supreme Court is granting certiorari, that is, taking the appeal of Paula Jones in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Jones lawyers are openly on television announcing they're going to go into the issue of other women in this case, and President Clinton is having his affair with Monica Lewinsky in the White House. Now, that is reckless, and as some friends of mine who are good, strong, conservative Republicans say, we may have come in with the elephant gun, but Bill Clinton supplied the bullets. Even if you take Ken Starr out of this picture entirely, Jeff, the train that was coming down the track at President Clinton was still coming down the track, and that was the Paula Jones case deposition where he was going to have to answer questions under oath about other women, including Monica Lewinsky.
Mm-hmm. Without Paula Jones and her case, much of the story doesn't happen quite the same way.
Oh, absolutely. It vanishes. I mean, you never can get to the Monica Lewinsky matter. That crucial element just evaporates.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, and it's sort of a side note, but it's a fascinating one with, I think, broader historical consequences, and that is the role of the Secret Service and what they can and can't report.
Well, I found that to be just a complete surprise piece of this story. No one else had reported it. I got access to the former head of the Secret Service, Lou Merletti, who was from Pittsburgh originally. I found him in Cleveland. He thought for months and then agreed to talk to me, and his story was just chilling. He fought tooth and nail to prevent Ken Starr and his prosecutors from subpoenaing the Secret Service agents because of the precedent this would set. The whole way that Secret Service agents are able to protect the life of the president is to have that trust and confidence. They have to be close to him, and if they're going to be snitches who can be brought in to testify about what they've seen and heard, the presidents will push away, and that will literally endanger presidents. And even President Bush number one wrote a letter of support agreeing that that was a true danger. But as with everything in this case, there was no restraint. And so Ken Starr's office was pushing hard on this. And it turned out this Secret Service story was just incredible because I learned that there was a battle at the top of the pyramid between the Secret Service and the FBI. The FBI was supporting much more Ken Starr's investigation. And Lou Merletti told a story of how he literally was a high-ranking FBI official tried to set him up to give him false information that the blue dress had no DNA on it to try to ensnare him and President Clinton. So this was just a remarkable story. And as all this is going on, what Lou Merletti pointed out, as the FBI is interviewing women in Arkansas about their sexual relations with Bill Clinton, there is an attempted assassination of President Clinton that had never been reported until it came out in this book, in the Philippines by none other than Osama bin Laden. And so we see this just, you know, chilling in the background. There are people already beginning to plot an attack on our country as our whole country is fixated on the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
How does Ken Starr look back on this? How does he view it?
Well, I think Ken Starr looks back on it with, you know, some, you know, mixed feelings, in the sense that clearly he wishes that he hadn't been thrust into this position. I mean, he was called to duty. He felt it was an unwinnable job. His wife Alice actually hoped he didn't take the job originally. He is someone who believes in public service. I do think that after a point, though, again, when we get to the Monica Lewinsky stage of things, I saw no evidence of him being, you know, this political zealot out to get the president. But he did lose his compass at that stage where his team pushed to expand into the Lewinsky case, and he agreed to that. That, I believe, was a mistake, and I think in hindsight, he agrees that it would have been better if someone else had taken on that different case. And I think his legacy in all of this would have been different if that had happened.
What does this story tell us as you have connected all of these dots and put all of these pieces together? What does it tell us about the public perception of private acts of public officials?
Well, it's quite interesting. There are wires that crossed here that shouldn't have crossed, and it's hard to untangle them. I think, first of all, the public, or at least a large part of the public, now believes that they do have a right to know some of this information, that it is relevant to the moral character of a leader, and that's part of the information they're entitled to. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. The bigger problem is, for what purpose should you know it? Do you bring criminal charges against someone if they lie about a matter like this? Do you try to impeach them? And that's where the wires got crossed. Now, ultimately, the only hero, as far as I'm concerned in this book, at the end, was the American public, because when we got to the impeachment trial in the Senate, it was really the American public that finally sorted all of this out, said, we get it, we know he lied in this thing, you know, that part is clear, he shouldn't have done it, he shouldn't have had this affair, but the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Stop it, we've had enough, bring this to an end. And that was one of the few sane moments in this whole crazy sequence of events that is a period of American history we'll look back on and shake our heads and wonder how we allowed ourselves to get into this. But I do think that the cat is out of the bag now in terms of private lives being fair game for the public to know about. The question is, what do we do about that? And ultimately, we should leave that to the political arena, not to criminal and impeachment mechanisms.
And then the broader question, whether or not we are better off as a nation knowing all of this.
Yes, well, that is a big question. It's interesting. I interviewed folks in Germany, France, England about all of this as it was going on. They were just shocked that we would do this to ourselves, as they said. They thought it demeaned the United States to go through this process. And in those countries, it's well known often that their leaders are having affairs. They know the phone numbers of the mistresses, they told me. But it just isn't something they feel is part of what they deserve to know. Our country, I guess, has taken a turn here, and I think it's going to be difficult to, you know, to undo that. Look at the recent example with Tiger Woods, for instance. Mm-hmm. He's not even a public official, and the public feels invested in this story. So I assume that it is a piece of the information one is entitled to know, but the irony of it, Jeff, is that the public pretty well knew the story of Bill Clinton before it elected him. the first time with the Jennifer Flowers episode, and certainly the second time, but they understood that and still felt that he was a good leader and made that decision.
You talk about the American public as being the hero of this story. As you look back on all of this and all the coverage, how did the media do in covering this story?
Pretty poorly, actually. The media was one of the culprits here for a couple of reasons. I think that many of the editors of newspapers and publishers and producers of television shows who were in charge of the American media had cut their teeth during Watergate and had grown up revering Woodward and Bernstein, and now this was their chance to be a part of history, and I think that they fell headlong into this and became very sloppy. I interviewed Walter Cronkite before he died, and it was just vivid to him that there were so many corners cut here. And of course, then we have the injection of the internet with Matt Drudge for the first time really driving this forward in the 24-hour news cycle. But there was a lot of sloppiness here where rumor was passed off for news. There was the Dallas Morning News story about allegedly Secret Service agents catching President Clinton and Monica in the act, and that turned out to be false, but it shot around the world before it was retracted. So, unfortunately, I think the media just jumped into this head first, and it was very late in the game where they realized that they had probably gone overboard.
Ken Gormley, his book is The Death of American Virtue, Clinton versus Starr. Ken, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, it has been a real pleasure.
Thank you.